From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
There are a lot of words you could use to describe Shane Clifton. He's a husband, a father, a friend, a professor, a theologian, an author. But when you meet him, you'll also notice that he's in a wheelchair because Shane is also a quadriplegic.
One word we're deliberately not using to describe him, though, is inspiration. Later we'll hear Shane explain his problem with what he calls the positivity myth. He's also got some insights to share on what the Bible and Christianity have to say about disability. But first, we asked him about what it means to be a quadriplegic, what his day-to-day life is like.
Yeah, it's one of those scary words, actually. And whenever people think of quadriplegia, they think of Superman, Christopher Reeve, who couldn't move from the neck down. My break is in my fifth vertebrae, which means I've got basically no movement from the chest down. I've got biceps, no triceps. So I've got a little more movement than Christopher Reeve, but basically quadriplegia just means you've got a spinal cord injury that's affected four limbs. What it means for your day is it really does impact every single part of your life. So I, for example, have carers get me up in the morning, shower me, dress me, put me to bed at night, and I need help throughout the day. Of course, you get used to doing things more independently as you learn to live more. So it affects every part of your life, there's no doubt about that.
This audio is from a home video of Shane Clifton and his family on holidays in 2010. His wife Ellie is filming, his kids are riding skateboards down a ramp and landing in a foam pit. There's a mattress in there as well. Then you see Shane at the top of the ramp on a push bike. He flies down, gets a bit of air, and lands head first in the foam pit. It looks just like all the other landings, but it's not. This is the moment that Shane broke his neck and became a quadriplegic.
If it's not too awful to go back over this, tell us about how this happened.
Yeah, I was on holidays at the South Coast. My family grew up in Nowra, and we were visiting actually a local church down there which had set up for their youth group a facility where there was a jump where you'd ride a skateboard or a push bike into a foam pit. And the foam pit was meant to make it safe, so my kids were doing it, and I thought...
You thought, that looks like fun.
Yes, 2 weeks before my 40th birthday, so what do you do with that? So I had a go. The first time I did it, I landed upside down in the pit, and I knew immediately that I'd broken my neck. I couldn't move anything. I yelled out to my wife, who was on the side there with my kids, and she thought I was joking at first, but it didn't take long to realise that wasn't the case. So I remember just apologising to my wife for repeatedly this sense that I've done something I knew was going to impact our whole family drastically. So, yeah, called the paramedics. I ended up, well, actually I spent, you know, probably about an hour and a half in the pit really, which was very scary because they can't move you at all. One of the keys to spinal cord injury is to keep the person as still as you can. A lot of the damage to the spinal cord is done after the neck is broken because the neck provides protection to the spinal cord. So they very gingerly moved me out of the foam pit and flew me by helicopter up to Prince of Wales Hospital in Sydney.
It's a sort of horror story for most people to think of what happened to you.
I mean, horror is a good word for it. I spent a couple of weeks in ICU, had my 40th birthday party in ICU, you know, in and out of consciousness, struggling to breathe. Then they move you from there to the spinal ward and begin rehabilitation. You're learning the most basic skills of life. Again, it's, you know, how do you... even just to sit into a wheelchair takes about a week to work out how to do. I remember going outside the first time in a wheelchair. They pushed me outside and bursting into tears because I felt so vulnerable sitting in a wheelchair. So I spent 7 months in hospital, which is way too long to spend in hospital. I learnt to hate with a passion hospital food, which is bland and disgusting. Mm. Relearning the basic skills of life.
In the immediate aftermath, in those dark times, tell us about how faith did or didn't play a role then.
you know, one of the toughest things about a spinal cord injury is when you're lying in bed at night, unable to get out of your bed, your family's gone home, you're in hospital sort of on your own. So prayer was helpful for me. I was able to, you know, sense some presence of God in the midst of those dark times. So that was important. There's no doubt about that. But look, it would be untrue to say that I didn't experience a lot of doubt. And maybe interestingly enough, not in the early days. I felt a real sense of the peace of God in the early days, and also just the amazing love of my family, friends, both Christian and non-Christian. But I received a lot of prayer as well, and I think that means a lot. It's an expression of love, so I valued it greatly.
Shane, this was such a freak accident that you were involved in. You know, you could do the same thing 1,000 times and it would be fine. Have you dwelt much on that question of, you know, why me?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. You know, the first question you also ask is, well, actually, do you exist, God? So I've experienced doubt over the years. I've put a lot of thought into it. There's no easy answers, of course.
Are there hard answers?
I think there's lots of different types of answers. Look, I think the standard answer that's often given to that is it's a consequence of sin, you know, free will and sin. And I think there's some truth in that. Obviously, a lot of the terrible things that happen to us are a consequence of bad decisions of ourselves and others. In my case, it's hard to put it down to that. Now, look, the truth is the foam pit was badly built. That's negligence, maybe, rather than sin. But I broke my neck because I did a human thing and fell over. So I can't pin that one on sin, really. So what I've really had to do is to face up to the very nature of human life. And I think that no one is good at that. We live in a society where we've put to the side our fragility. You know, we live in a world where health, independence, power is part of our everyday. And we've sort of lost sight of the fact of the cycle of life, that we're born fragile, dependent, that sure, we grow and develop our strength and develop our capacity, but we're always still fragile and we're heading toward death as well. So the cycle of sort of life, the wonder and the joy of life, all the good things that we've got in life are actually connected to that cycle of sort of the relationship between fragility and vulnerability. So I think really for me it was facing up to or paying serious attention to the fact that the good things that I've got in life are also a product of the difficulties and the challenges and the frailties. So if I can accept the wonder of the cycle of life, I guess I have to accept the consequences of that, which in my case was a spinal cord injury.
I know that you would never have been glad of this terrible accident, but having experienced the accident, are there things that, and you sometimes hear people say this sort of thing, are there things that you've come to appreciate differently or in a richer way, perhaps?
It's a really interesting question, because I've interviewed a number of people who've lived with spinal cord injury for a long time. And I have actually come across a person with an injury higher than mine who says he's glad of the spinal cord injury because it gave him pause to pay attention to his life in a way that he hadn't done before. And since that, he feels like he's lived a more meaningful life, which I thought was sort of really intriguing. I don't feel that at all. I had a fantastic life, a great marriage. I enjoyed my job. If I could go back in time, I'd do it in a second. But having said that, I have learned a lot. You know, as I mentioned before, the amazing generosity of friends, family and strangers has been fantastic. Probably the thing that I've learned the most is this beautiful disabled community that I knew nothing about before, to my shame. This is a group of people who've lived with that fragility we've talked about. They've lived with society that often judges them and an environment that keeps them out. And yet I've just discovered in meeting disabled people some wonderful fascinating, funny, joyous, full of life people. So I think it's the one of the great things is, yeah, finding myself with this community of people that I'd paid no attention to before. So
you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Now, you've probably seen those posters. They generally show someone with a disability achieving some sort of goal, looking super impressive. And they usually sport a caption, something like, "The only disability in life is a bad attitude," or "What's your excuse?" Now, these are meant to be inspirational posters, but for people living with a disability, it doesn't always come across that way. There's a term for this, actually. Disability rights activist Stella Young was the first to call it inspiration porn. Shane Clifton explains.
There's a technical difference between what they call the medical and the social model of disability. I don't know if you've heard of that before, but we tend to think of disability as a problem in the body, and it's a problem with the individual who's got the disability, and the solution to that is to fix the body in one way or another, or the brain. Whereas disabled advocates have realised that actually disability is a social problem, and that people are disabled because we don't shape our environment to accommodate people's embodied differences. And that might be simple things like ramps to get into buildings, sign interpreters in our meetings, or various other things. So I think society and the media tends to present disability as a problem with the person. And then that also comes out in the way in which they talk about disabled people overcoming their problems. So there's this thing which I call the positivity myth, which has this idea that if you've got a positive attitude, you can overcome the constraints of your disability or...
It's not disconnected from that thing that people tell children at schools all the time, that you can be anything you want to be.
Yeah.
Which isn't true.
No.
I've found this out.
Yeah.
It's sort of connected, isn't it?
Yeah, the winner of The Voice every year will go, "I dreamed a dream, and if you dream it, look what'll happen to you."
I haven't heard me sing that.
Well, the fact is we've just watched 99 people get knocked out of the competition. Didn't work for them. And look, you know, you can't overcome the constraints of disability, especially if it's society working against you. So I get really tired of the positivity myth, which is whenever you see a disabled person, the one who's presented is the person who's overcome. The stories in the media will be the person who got a spinal cord injury who managed to walk at the end of it. And you know what? That's not generally a consequence of a positive attitude. It's he was just fortunate or she was just fortunate that the spinal cord healed up.
So if you could choose kind of how disability was represented or influence it a bit more, what kind of stories would you want to see told?
Real life stories of successes and failures and virtues and vices. I think what people with disabilities wanted to be represented at is not normal, because who wants to be normal? But the same as everybody else. We're a community of normal, funny people who've got this really many of the same challenges. So when you see a disabled person, you know, doing something, don't say, "Isn't that great because they're disabled?" For example, say, "Aren't they doing a fantastic thing?" So praise them for their accomplishments. Not as soon as you say, "Oh, that's amazing because they're disabled," you're actually diminishing what it is they're doing. You're seeing the disability, not the thing that the person's doing. So my point would be just do your best to treat people
as people,
yeah.
How important is the language around all this in terms of, you know, words like, as you say, normal, even the word disability? How should we kind of be speaking?
Oh, these are really good questions, actually. Look, language functions. So the language you use to describe things often expresses your innate, your unthought of attitudes. So look, I'm a big fan with my students on gender inclusive language. I don't think that's about political correctness. I think that's about expressing what it is you believe. And the same is true, I think, of disability. I think it can get tiring, it can go too far, What happens is we keep changing the words for disability. Spastic becomes handicapped, becomes disabled, and now we can't say disabled. And what's happening here each time is we're trying to change a word, and that doesn't fix the problem. The problem's the fact that the society's not changing. So we can keep changing the language, but until society starts to change the way they look and treat people with disabilities or disabled people, which one of those is right?
I'm getting nervous now.
I do. One of the things I love is for disabled people to choose the language for themselves. And one of the great things that they've done is often taken labels of derision and owned them. Disabled people, for example, have taken the label cripple. And, you know, so crip has become a word of power and sort of self-identity. So I think language makes a big difference, especially when people own these words for themselves.
Shane, you're not only a Christian, you're a Christian theologian.
So don't hold that against me.
Well, we might have to. But you're thinking deeply about these questions of faith and how they apply to real life. Are there ways in which the Christian story itself shapes how you think about disability?
I think the Christian gospel is significant for people with disabilities because it does recognise the fact that suffering is an inherent part of the story of the gospel. And so for me, it's been lovely to be able to see myself as part of that story. Disability is throughout the Bible. You sort of don't really notice it probably until you maybe really go looking for it. It's interesting even to sort of think of Jesus as somehow disabled on the cross. So when you see artworks of the sort of disabled body of Christ, I think those things become very powerful for speaking or for inviting people like myself and others into the gospel story.
Just what you're speaking about there makes me think of the philosopher Nietzsche, who kind of condemns Christianity as a religion of weakness and pity and that being a betrayal of the strong and strength being the ultimate virtue and so on. But I think our society would want to side not with Nietzsche's vision of strength and that being the greatest virtue.
Yeah, look, I've got a lot of sympathy with Nietzsche in many ways. I think he's one of the most fantastic philosophers. And certainly for people with disabilities, one of the things that Nietzsche does do is he looks at Christianity, the virtue tradition, which had led up to where he was. And he says, this religion has often kept you in your place because you've allowed the church's presentation of virtue to keep you humble, to keep you quiet, to sort of moderate your anger and your rage. So that side of Nietzsche I have some sympathy for, because I think that people with disabilities need to be able to rage against what's the way in which society's treated them. But of course, he says a lot wrong. And obviously the great thing about the gospel story, unlike ancient Greek society, certainly like in Rome, the high point of Rome was the virtuous man who's essentially a strong warrior. And yet in the gospel story, it's oriented all to the broken, to the vulnerable. So it really does reorient our priorities and reorient the sort of people who are important.
And what about the place of hope? What difference does that make for you?
Oh, look, I don't think you can get through a spinal cord injury or spinal cord injury recovery without hope. It's interesting because some of the studies on spinal cord injury, so even false hope sort of works. It's amazing how, especially in the early few months, it's the hope that I'm going to walk, which is enough to sort of get people through those initial stages, even if it proves unlikely. So for me, I think hope, I'd like to think it had some more substance than that. I never really thought I was going to walk again. Maybe I'm too much of a, I don't know, pessimist or whatnot. But I had hope that God would be with me. Hope is as Jürgen Moltmann talks about it, as you look to the future, but it affects the present. Definitely hope enables you to sort of, in the worst of times, believe that that's not the end and keep going. So I've needed it a lot of different days over the last 6 years.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. We were speaking with Shane Clifton, Dean of Theology at Alpha Crucis College in Sydney, about his experience as a quadriplegic.
If you want to know more about his story, Shane's published a book called Husbands Should Not Break, a memoir about the pursuit of happiness after spinal cord injury. It's available in bookstores and online.
Next week, the power of music for people living with dementia.